Joining me right now is Sarah Isker, staff writer for The Dispatch and host of the Advisory Opinions podcast. Sarah, we've got a lot to run through. Let me start, though, with the news today that the House is moving forward with the second impeachment of President Trump. The article of impeachment they've laid out and the process that's about to play out. Your thoughts?
Right. So the Constitution lays out the power of impeachment. This goes back, by the way, to the Declaration of Independence. I mean, the founding fathers listed their 27 grievances against the king. It's actually, you know, people think of the Declaration of Independence as this like soaring document of rhetoric. In fact, it is, but it also has this like bullet by bullet. You did this, you did this, you're a bad person. And so 11 years later, they write the Constitution, and it is all about preventing tyranny from the presidency. And the impeachment power is key to that. So, as we all know, because we've been through it already this presidential term, majority of the House votes on, in this case, one article of impeachment. That gets sent over to the Senate for a trial. The Senate has to have two-thirds to convict the president on that article of impeachment. And then the Constitution says, judgment in cases of impeachment shall not extend further than to removal from office and disqualification to hold any future office, basically. And so what that means is once you've been convicted, the only two things that the Senate can do to punish you is remove you from office and disqualify you from holding any future office. We know that they have the votes in the House to pass this article of impeachment with Democrats alone, of course. The big question politically is how many Republican House members will join them. They don't need any. So on the one hand, Democrats could, you know, write up Donald Trump is a stinky poo-poo face, and they would still pass that as an article of impeachment, no doubt. But does Nancy Pelosi, do the leaders in the Democratic House want to get as many Republican votes as possible? There is probably a way to do that, but it's going to involve, you know, sitting down with Republicans, something they have not been that inclined to do. But again, that's all just politics. When you get over to the Senate, though, it's not politics, because the Senate right now has 99 members. David Perdue's term lapsed on January 3rd. Those two Georgia members haven't been seated yet. So there's 99 members in the Senate. You need two-thirds. That's 66. So until those two Georgia members get seated, which the Secretary of State of Georgia has said may not happen until after inauguration, which will be very relevant in a second, 48 Democrats, which means you need 18 Republicans. Well, 18 is a pretty high number, Ryan.
Yes. Yes, it is. Good luck with that.
So you can get kind of close. I certainly can count to eight that are definitely considering it, maybe even leaning towards it. 10 more, maybe, I don't know. But there's some options here. For instance, there are reasons to want to remove Trump from office. For instance, under the Former President's Act, a former president is entitled to a pension. They're entitled to office space. They're entitled to staff paid for by taxpayers. But former president is defined as anyone who has held the office of the presidency of the United States and left the presidency under any situation other than impeachment.
Okay.
So if he is removed by the Senate, he gets rid of his pension, things like that. That's a big deal. But other than that, the real thing that people seem to be looking toward is the disqualifying him from running again in 2024.
Yeah.
Okay, so a couple things here. Democrats will pick up two more votes. So instead of 18 Republican votes, they would only need 16 after probably Joe Biden is president. Can you impeach a sitting president but convict a former president? There's one really relevant precedent for this. In 1876, the Secretary of War was about to be impeached. He resigned literally like an hour before the unanimous impeachment vote. Turns out he had a really clumsy kickback scheme, by the way. Like super clumsy. Word to the wise, if you're going to have a conspiracy, you want to involve fewer people, not more people.
Which has always been the ironic part about the widespread voter fraud conspiracy theory for the 2020 election. It would take so many people. I don't know. I think it would have come to life.
20,000 people were involved in this conspiracy, but all of them are super tight knit and for some reason pedophiles.
Right.
That part I've never really understood why that's necessary, but it appears to be necessary that they are voter fraudsters and also pedophiles. So
Both.
in 1876, this guy resigns an hour before the unanimous impeachment vote. It goes to the Senate, and they get 35 votes. They needed 40 for the two-thirds because 23 senators said, according to the text of the Constitution, you can't impeach a former office holder. It very specifically says president. It doesn't say former president. It says federal officer, not former federal officer. So I think that's a big problem, A. So getting those two extra votes, lowering the number of Republicans you need by two votes, probably not worth it given that other huge constitutional hurdle. However, Ryan, there are two other options.
Okay.
One, the 14th Amendment, Section 3 says that no person can hold office who basically has previously taken an oath to the U.S. Constitution and then engaged in insurrection or rebellion against the U.S. Constitution. Interesting. What is insurrection or rebellion? That would be talked about a lot at that point.
Yeah. And the
But in
president's
eight,
role in everything, did he
that's
specifically
right.
tell them to go? You know, all that kind of stuff.
Okay, so I don't love that option for a variety of it's just messy reasons. Those are real terms. They mean something. We can get to incitement. That's a criminal code term. Okay, but I've got one more thing. In 1898, Congress passed a law that allows Congress to disqualify someone from holding office through legislation, i.e., the Democratic-controlled House and the Democratic-controlled Senate, with the signature of President Biden, could pass a law that just says Donald Trump shall be disqualified from holding federal or state office
Wow.
related to his actions on January 6, 2021.
I don't know that that will be as easy to get through a
No.
Democratic, specifically Senate, or have President, then President Joe Biden, have him get involved and sign. I don't know that that would be that easy. So I.
Yeah, what's funny is it's the easiest of the options, and
Yeah.
I think that everyone involved would sort of be like, ooh, this is a precedent we may not want to be setting.
Right. I'm joined by Sarah Isker, staff writer for the Dispatch and host of the Advisory Opinions podcast. I want to go back to something because this always comes up, and this came up during the last impeachment, high crimes and misdemeanors. People saying, what did he do that fits that definition? It's very loose. It can be a lot of things. It doesn't have to be criminal, correct?
Oh, it's whatever a majority of the House of Representatives says it is, and then it's whatever two-thirds of the Senate agrees that the House of Representatives said it was. And it definitely, we know for certain that it doesn't have to be criminal. That is not an open question. What it does have to be, again, is a political question, and courts are never going to weigh in on that, is the definition of, in legal terms, it's called political question doctrine. And this is the idea that there are some things in the Constitution that are left wholly to the political branches. And the number one thing that people point to is high crimes and misdemeanors for impeachment. But we know that impeachment was not just for crimes, because again, look to the Declaration of Independence and the entire point of the Constitution, Federalist 47 and 69, which both, that's Madison and Hamilton for those who love their musicals. That's where they said that they were creating a presidency to guard against the dangerous tendency to an accumulation of power, right? That's what impeachment is about, is preventing a tyrant. So yeah, it doesn't need to be criminal because we don't have a criminal code against tyranny.
Right. And that's why, and I've said this before, I'll say it again. If the founders are rolling in their graves for one thing, it's how much power Congress has given the executive branch over the past couple of decades. That is just something that I don't think if they were here today, they would be able to under they'd be like, what the hell happened? That was not what we were looking to do at all. And people always talk about, and I'm curious to get your thoughts, the three co-equal branches of government, but really when you study it, it certainly seems to me like the founders wanted Congress to be the ones who were the most in charge.
Yeah, no, they're not co-equal branches. No. There's a
Congress is Article One for a reason.
That's right. You know, the prime minister in Great Britain is called primus inter pares, meaning first among equals, you know, like, yeah, the ministers are all equal, sure, but he's the prime minister. That's the exact same thing with the legislative branch. Yes, they're equal branches, kind of. The legislative branch was always supposed to be the guard, the last bastion in the guard against tyranny. It is called our seat of government for a reason, not the White House. There's a reason the White House is like at the bottom in the swampy part of DC, closer to the Potomac where the mosquitoes and malaria were. And the Capitol is up on the hill where there was a nice breeze, far fewer mosquitoes and malaria, and had this lovely view of the whole city, like down onto the president down in the muck in the swamp.
Yeah. And this whole idea that members of Congress would put their party's well-being above not the country's, but just Congress's own powers, that they would not get. They would, that one they didn't see coming.
Well, we'll have to save my rant on the administrative state for another time. But basically, the legislative function of the government has not just it's that the executive has become more powerful. It's more insidious than that. It's that the legislative power now resides within the administrative state that is under the executive.
Yeah.
They can conduct trials. They can make laws and regulations. I mean, it is bonkers town on how much Congress has just said, so if you could just do something about, I don't know, clean water, you guys figure out the details.
Right.
No, it was your job to figure out the details.
That's a little bit too much work. That's asking too much. I'm joined by Sarah Isker, staff writer for The Dispatch and host of the Advisory Opinions podcast. Going back to the criminal code for a moment, because I'm pretty sure this was part of a recent podcast that you did, the criminal incitement charge that some people were musing about after the insurrection at the Capitol, that it could be applied to the president. That again goes to, and I come back to this so much, it's not so much what you know or what you think you know, it's what you can prove, and that's often a lot more difficult than people seem to think.
Yeah, and this is tough, right? Because if you talk about this in sort of the clinical legal terms of the elements of the crime and what needs to be proven and what evidence we have, I feel like I am minimizing what happened on January 6th. So I want to start by saying that I have been coursing between anger and sadness. And for me, it all is that moment where they are trying to lower the American flag, which has 50 stars, one for each of our states. It has 13 stripes for each of our colonies. It is the symbol of our unity and a symbol of our country. It is a symbol of the experiment of self-government. They tried to lower that and raise a flag that just said Trump on it, which is a man. It is a person. That is what we signed the Declaration of Independence about.
Right.
So I just want to get that out of the way.
We've litigated this before, and it's amazing that it's come back up all these years later.
Literally did this before. Mm-hmm. Okay. That being said, incitement requires two things. One, that the person charged with incitement wanted to incite that riot or insurrection or violence, whatever. And two, that a reasonable person listening to them would have thought that those words, you know, would lead to or could incite violence, insurrection, et cetera. So that's actually a pretty high bar. And, you know, you have the First Amendment in there, and that's the reason there's a high bar. So not only do you have to show, and I think this is the easier side, that there were a whole lot of violent elements in that crowd, and the crowd was already getting rowdy, and you know, people in the crowd have said that it was like dry tinder out there. So I think it's not going to be that hard to prove that a reasonable person would think that, you know, you say pretty much anything to that crowd and like They were ready to go. But the much harder element of this is that the person speaking actually intended their words to be used like that. And if you go through and you read the president's speech, and yes, I understand the context. Again, like, it was a tinderbox out there. But the words he was saying were not that different than what he has said at his rallies before. And, you know, he used the word fight several times. You know, in law, we talk about fighting words.
Yeah.
Fighting words are not protected under the First Amendment. And he used the word fight a whole lot. And I've seen people say, like, therefore they're fighting words. Except he, like, at one point says, right now we are fighting. As in, he uses the term metaphorically throughout. Mm-hmm. And he's saying we, I. So clearly he meant fighting. He uses, you know, our members in Congress need to fight for this. And in the context of that, you know, sentence, what he's saying is the fight that they need to do is the vote for the objection.
Yeah. You can see how radicalized people could take it the way they took it and storm the Capitol. But the president, and this matters in a criminal sense, not impeachment or any of that, but in a criminal sense, it matters that he didn't say, you all should go storm the Capitol right now.
Yeah. Yeah. And if you run into any federal officers who get in your way, pick up that nearest fire extinguisher, beat your way through there if you need to. The important thing is to get, you know, like, that's not what he was saying. It was a lot of metaphor. And that doesn't make it okay. It was the sitting president of the United States encouraging rebellion against our seat of government. Mm-hmm. But that's why we have impeachment. It's not that any person saying that would have been so offensive. It's that it was the president. And if that's the difference, that's not incitement, that's impeachable.
And this has come up in a number of different things, whether it was the Russia investigation, before that, the Hillary Clinton email investigation. A lot of times what I find is that people will take something and, hey, it looks bad, smells bad. It's probably reasonable to think it's bad, but that's also different when you're talking in the criminal context of being able to prove it beyond a reasonable doubt. That just changes the game. And too often, especially these days where it's like lock everybody up, that's what everybody seems to be reaching for. They're missing a big part of the puzzle here.
Yeah, and we also have lots and lots of case law on incitement. It is just very hard, and we want it to be hard.
Yeah.
We want people to be able to say things, especially even against their government, and not be charged with incitement, quote unquote. We want Black Lives Matter protests to be able to take place and to say that, you know, the police are being unreasonable. So it's a very high bar. I think reasonable people can disagree on whether there's enough to charge the president after he leaves office for incitement. I have difficulty, though, that reasonable people can disagree over whether that burden can be met in trial.
No, I agree. It was interesting hearing you, and you were on the podcast, of course, with David French, and he had a little bit of a different take. He was a little bit leaning in a tiny bit more into there might be something that we can work with.
And he says, we'll find more evidence. Well, okay, if you find more evidence, I will definitely revisit this.
I tended to agree with you as I was listening, and that's not just because you're the one that comes on the podcast and David's never been on before. It's just because on the merits, I thought you were right with the argument there. Staff writer for the Dispatch and host of the Advisory Opinions podcast, Sarah Isker. We're going to have you back on because I got to get your thoughts on big tech and the response to last week's insurrection and the president's role in it. Also, the self-pardon issue keeps popping up. The president, I guess, was advised by White House counsel and former Attorney General Barr not to do it. So I know those are some things that you have some thoughts on. I definitely want to have you back on for that. But for today, I think that's enough. I think we've covered enough. Well, I think I've used you enough here in terms of all your legal knowledge and constitutional knowledge. So we'll wrap it up there. Sarah, thanks so much for the time. We appreciate it.
You bet.